This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Brian Naylor in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Today, Iran announced it's restarting some nuclear activities that it had suspended for a year, flouting a demand by the International Atomic Energy Agency that it freeze all such activity. Tehran says its nuclear program is solely for power generation and peaceful purposes, but virtually no one believes them. Meanwhile, North Korea is continuing what most experts believe is an extensive nuclear weapons program. While there's no conclusive proof North Korea possesses nuclear bombs, most analysts believe Pyongyang has one, maybe two nuclear weapons, and the capability to make several more. Today on Talk of the Nation, we'll look at the accessibility of nuclear materials and weapons, and why the nuclear programs of Iran and North Korea are considered especially dangerous. A bit later, we'll examine a new judicial ruling that could affect campaign financing. But first, our update on nuclear proliferation and the latest news from Iran and North Korea. How concerned are you about the nuclear threats from countries like Iran and North Korea? Should they be discouraged from building nuclear weapons? And what about the U.S. response, politically, diplomatically, militarily? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. With us from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles is Mike Schuster, NPR's diplomatic correspondent. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Brian.
Mike, bring us up to date, if you would, on the latest news from Iran. President Mohammad Khatami did not hide his plans for pursuing a nuclear program in his statement today.
No, the president of Iran, Mohammad Khatami, gave a speech at a military parade in Tehran that marks an anniversary of the 1980s war with Iraq, in which he said that Iran will continue its what he says are peaceful nuclear activities. He denied, as he has regularly for years, that Iran wants to acquire a nuclear bomb or a nuclear weapons potential, but he insisted that Iran has the right to acquire peaceful nuclear technology, and he said that's what Iran will do, whether there are international sanctions or not. At the same time, in Vienna, where the International Atomic Energy Agency's general conference is meeting this week, an Iranian vice president, who's also head of Iran's Atomic Energy Agency, announced that Iran has begun testing of a process known as uranium conversion, which turns uranium ore, which is relatively raw uranium from the ground, into a gas, uranium hexafluoride, that then at the next stage could be used to enrich uranium, which eventually could be used to fuel a nuclear weapon. The IAEA, just over this past weekend, had adopted a resolution requiring Iran to stop all of these activities and to keep them suspended. This announcement, although not unexpected, seems to be flouting that resolution.
And Mike, why did the President Khatami make this announcement such an open public move?
Well, this is has been Khatami's position, his public position, and public policy of the government of Tehran for at least the last year, openly, and certainly in an undisclosed fashion for many years. And I think that Khatami made this statement today because of the resolution that was adopted over the weekend in Vienna, calling on Iran not to carry out some of these nuclear activities. There is a strong nationalist feeling in Iran, even though Iran is a divided nation and has a divided government. As best as we can tell, there is a great deal of sentiment across the political spectrum for pursuing a nuclear capability in Iran, whether that means that most of the population of Iran would like to see Iran acquire a nuclear weapon, as some hardliners seem to want, that's not clear. But there's a reaction in Iran against the pressure that's coming from the International Atomic Energy Agency, and particularly the United States. And I think as President Khatami is tapping into that.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, the IAEA has been putting pressure on Iran. What does today's announcement say about their credibility? Iran doesn't seem particularly concerned about defying this multinational nuclear watchdog agency.
No, but Iran, the Iranian government has been jockeying with the IAEA and with the Europeans and with the United States over the past year. The most important element to the agreement that the Europeans got the Iranians to accept a year ago was that they would stop enriching uranium, because if that process goes forward, it could become clear that Iran would have the fissile material, the explosive material that could go into a bomb. But there are a number of preliminary engineering and scientific steps that come before that. And as pressure has built on the Iranians, they have insisted that they have the right, under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which they're signatory to carry out these activities, short of uranium enrichment and short of acquiring the fissile material that might make a bomb. And so there is this international jockeying back and forth, and this is this step. The Iranians said that they were going to go ahead and do this testing of uranium conversion. The IAEA is actually monitoring it in Iran. And so there's a political jockeying in the international arena, and this will certainly continue for the next months to come.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for that overview. And please stay with us. We'd like to bring another guest now into the discussion. John Wolfstahl is Deputy Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's here with us in Studio 3A. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Brian. Pleasure to be here.
Tell me, what are your thoughts on Iran's announcement about uranium enrichment? Why was it made such a public decision against the wishes of the international community?
Well, I think there are two things that strike me right off the bat. The first is how quickly this announcement has come. Anyone who has watched this dance between the United States, the Europeans, and Iran over the last year should be surprised that Iran was going to push back hard against not only the International Atomic Energy Agency, but its member states. Remember that the agency is simply a body where the United States, France, Germany, other countries meet and coordinate. But the timing was so fast, it's another sign that Iran at least wants to project the image that it won't be bullied, it's going to do what it wants to do, and is almost daring or bluffing the United States or Europeans to decide what they're prepared to do about it. I think the second thing is that he's clearly playing to not just an international audience, but to a national audience. This has become a nationalistic issue in Iran. Mm-hmm. And whether we like the regime or not, we should recognize that they're all politicians and they're trying to appeal to their base of support. And so Khatami needs to, in a certain sense, appeal to the larger body here. He's in a fight for his political life, as he has been over the last several years, and he's trying to appeal to the most, the largest body of support he can.
As far as anyone knows, does Iran now have a nuclear weapon?
Well, I think we've all gotten a lot more careful over the past few years in terms of banding about allegations of what a country does or does not have. You can never prove a negative, but everything that we have seen, everything that the international agencies inspecting Iran has shown us is that they are not yet capable of building a nuclear weapon, and the timelines vary. You will hear people tell you they could be months away. Those people should tell you that that is a worst-case scenario. In some scenarios, they could be several years away. But the point at the heart of this is, in my mind, Iran clearly has a desire to acquire this technology, which gives them the ability to produce nuclear weapons. And the question is, what is the United States and its allies prepared to do about it?
Let's take a call now. Our number, once again, is 800-989-TALK. And Tom, in Chicago, you're on Talk of the Nation. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Here's the connection that I don't see being made in the press. Oil's at $50 a barrel. Iran and any of these other nations export huge amounts of oil. They're collecting, obviously, billions of dollars. And that money, to a certain extent, is going to fund, nuclear weapons. Why hasn't somebody simply said, if we come off of oil as a source of energy, we're going to change the background on these guys. They're not going to have this kind of money to spend on these types of weapons and potentially use them against the Western world. And I'll take my comment off the line.
All right, Tom, thanks very much. John, let me just throw that at you.
Sure. Well, I think it's an important point, although looking at the specific case of Iran, even if today we gave up our dependence on foreign oil, I think that in itself would not turn off the Iranian nuclear program. They have advanced to the point where if they want to, if they're willing to absorb the damage of an embargo or a blockade, they could still advance their nuclear program. But the larger point, I think, is an important one, which is to what extent does our money and our technology, as well as our political support, provide cover or enable these countries to acquire this technology. And it's not just in Iran or just for oil. We have connections with lots of states, whether that's Pakistan. We're now allies in the war on terrorism. They have nuclear weapons, and we're not sure they secure them the way they should. Other countries as well. Now, South Korea has been found that it may have been engaged in some secret nuclear experiments. We're very close allies. And the big question in my mind, and I think in part in the presidential election, is nonproliferation going to be a top priority? Is nuclear security really the biggest threat, or will it be one of many?
It's not something that's been talked about very much on the campaign trail by either President Bush or John Kerry. Why is that?
Well, I think the oil issue, I think John Kerry has tried to raise the oil issue. He's talked about energy independence as a critical part of his national security, but it's been very difficult, I think, for the public to get beyond the top-level headlines. To a certain extent, that's what the media has been reporting, and it has been more a campaign of symbols and images than of ideas at this point. And I think that's unfortunate because there is a big debate between the candidates and the intellectual approaches of the two parties, and I think that's a national debate we need to have.
Let's take another call now. Philip, you're on the air from Oakland, California. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, I have always had a little difficulty with the request of the developed nations, the ones that now hold nuclear weapons, to demand that developing countries not have them. I certainly understand our personal and national interest in accomplishing that goal, but it seems to me that unless we are willing to put all of the nuclear weapons that the developed nations now hold under an umbrella control like the UN, that at that point in time there would be the ability for the nations of the world to say, okay, now everybody else has to stop development. And I'm just wondering how we justify that.
All right. Thanks for your call. It's a good question, Mike Schuster. I want to toss it your way.
Well, in fact, that's the deal at the heart of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which most of the nations of the world have signed, including Iran, the United States and the other recognized nuclear powers essentially have pledged to eventually give up their nuclear weapons if the rest of the signatories of the treaty agree not to acquire them. But there is no specific timeline or timetable in the treaty to carry that out. And it is true that some nations have argued that the United States, Russia, and other nuclear powers have not in good faith taken steps to implement that. And there has been grown up an impatience among some nations, and I think you could put Iran in that category, given particularly the dangerous geographical neighborhood in which Iran is situated, some impatience about allowing that process to be so open-ended. It's debated among policymakers in the United States and around the world what that means, that the United States has pledged that eventually it will give up nuclear weapons as part of the deal. But no one can imagine a time when that treaty deal is actually implemented.
We're talking about the nuclear arms programs of Iran. When we come back from a short break, we'll add a discussion about North Korea with a former State Department official who's seen that country's nuclear facilities. Call us with your questions, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Brian Naylor. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Brian Naylor in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about the spread of nuclear weapons, particularly in Iran and North Korea, How concerned are you about nuclear threats from countries like Iran and North Korea? Should they be discouraged from building nuclear weapons? What about the response from the U.S. and the international community? Our guests are NPR's diplomatic correspondent Mike Schuster and John Wolfstahl, Deputy Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Joining us now is Jack Pritchard, former Special Envoy for Negotiations with North Korea for President Bush. He's now a visiting fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, and he joins us from Brookings. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Brian. It's nice to be here.
Let me begin with a question I asked earlier to John Wolfstahl about Iran. Does North Korea possess nuclear weapons as far as anyone knows?
Well, I think John kind of got it right. The answer is we don't really know. In the top of your show, you indicated that most people believe that in the pre-1994 time frame, we thought North Korea had one or two nuclear weapons. The CIA has briefed Congress publicly to say they have gone from, well, we believe they have it, to a more definitive, yes, they have one or two nuclear weapons. What we now believe in the last 2 years, since October of 2002, that the North Koreans have taken some action to reprocess spent fuel, extract plutonium, and do some things for which we give them the capability, and we believe they very well might have, develop an additional six nuclear weapons for a total of a possible eight. But in fact, we really don't know definitively whether or not they have actual nuclear weapons or not.
Now, there have been multi-six-party talks, including Japan, China, Russia, South Korea, North Korea, and the U.S. These were due to resume later this month, but that seems unlikely to happen now. Bring us up to speed a little bit with what's going on with that.
Yeah, it's very unlikely that this fourth round of six-party talks will occur. The North Koreans have indicated they don't intend to come back to the six-party process. They've cited as a primary example the nuclear experiments that the South Koreans have admitted to that took place in the form of laser enhancements in 2000 and some plutonium experiments in 1982. They want to see that fully investigated, and the North Koreans are saying, we want to check to see if there's a double standard in the way that the United States treats South Korea in the way that they treat us, the North Koreans. This is something concrete that they've actually hung their hat on. They really haven't wanted to come back to this round of six-party talks, but it's been a convenient tool for them to avoid this latest round of six-party talks while they wait for the U.S. presidential election to take place on the 2nd of November.
Let's take another call now. Once again, our number here is 800-989-TALK. And you can also email us at totn@npr.org. Lawrence in Portland, Oregon, thanks for joining the discussion.
Thank you for taking my call. I just have one question. I guess earlier on in the discussion, they indicated that it's very difficult to disprove with UN inspections, or that for that matter, to prove. What exactly, for a simplistic, mindset, how exactly do they start to search from building to building with intelligence, with photo radar? What exactly is the process that we're using to get confirmation or to what degree that they have any kind of nuclear armament or research?
Okay, that's a good question, Lawrence. Thank you. Jack Pritchard, how does the UN inspection process or the IAEA inspection process work?
Well, let me tackle the North Korean issue, and it's one that really must be voluntary in nature. And this is something that applies very specifically to the question of HEU, highly enriched uranium, which the United States believes the North Koreans have gone down a separate track other than what we know about their plutonium. But to find and to verify where their HEU program is, where we right now don't know will require the North Koreans to fully cooperate with the IAEA. If not, we'd be in a position to do something that we were incapable of doing in Iraq, and that is an absolutely intrusive search throughout the country in North Korea, and we're certainly not in a position as an occupier of North Korea to accomplish that. So in this particular case, when it's an unknown program, it requires a full level of cooperation or a level that would be satisfactory to allow the IAEA to begin the process of searching bit by bit and uncovering the evidence that would allow us to then compare it to what we believe our intelligence has told us about the North Korean program.
Mm-hmm.
It should be noted that there are not IAEA inspectors right now in North Korea. There were during the 1990s, but the North Koreans expelled them from the country nearly 2 years ago, whereas in the Iranian case, there are many IAEA inspectors all over Iran inspecting all the sites that they believe are connected to the nuclear activities there, and that to that degree, the Iranian government is cooperating with the IAEA.
I'm wondering, Jack, you mentioned Iraq a minute ago. One of the stated reasons for the U.S. Invasion of Iraq was because of the threat, the concern that Iraq might possess a nuclear weapons program. I'm wondering if this war has had any impact on Iraq or North Korea. It doesn't seem to have deterred either of those nations from moving ahead with their own programs.
Well, if I may, quite the contrary, it has spurred the North Koreans, at least verbally. The North Koreans, for their part, as an example, they would call me periodically to New York to explain what they were going to be doing in advance. And as they watched events unfold in Iraq, they began to change their rationale from one in which they were hoping to tell me that they were only reprocessing the spent fuel for safety reasons. They very blatantly came out and said, we see what's happening in Iraq, and we are going to need a deterrent to keep you from militarily attacking us. So we are going to reprocess our spent fuel, and we're going to create a nuclear deterrent so you will not attack us.
I'd like to bring our other guests back into the conversation. John Wolfstahl here with us in Studio 3A, Deputy Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. John, you wanted to chip in?
I think your last question is a critical point, and we were talking about the presidential election and what sort of debate is being had. President Bush and his top advisors, when they went to war in Iraq, were asked, are there lessons in the war for Iran and North Korea? And the Undersecretary of State, John Bolton, who's the leading spokesperson and coordinator, said, there is. Take a number. There was a firm belief that through a position of strength and through using preemptive attacks, that you could intimidate states that had the ability to produce these weapons. And I think what we found is that while in some cases, like Libya, where you had a very effective sanctions regime and you had an international consensus that this was a problem, sometimes that can work. But at the same time, you have cases in North Korea and in Iran where that philosophy has backfired. And in fact, as Jack said, those programs have accelerated. We are now facing a much greater nuclear threat, both in the regions of East Asia and the Middle East, and eventually to the homeland as a result of this position. Now, I would argue that you do need to have a strong foreign policy, and you do need to rely ultimately on military force if everything else fails. But you need to use that effectively and say, here's the stick, and then we're going to engage in a diplomatic process. And unfortunately, to my view, the Bush administration has talked about that process but hasn't really shown a lot of interest in following through.
I'm wondering if we could address for a moment, how do other nations with nuclear weapons convince other countries not to develop them? What's it's the carrot and the stick again.
This is one of the other questioners had a great point, and the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed Al-Baradei, has a great quote in saying that it's like somebody with a cigarette dangling from their mouth telling somebody else not to smoke. It's a very hard argument to sell, and in fact, it's made that much harder by the fact that the United States not only possesses these weapons, but is now thinking about building a new generation of nuclear weapons. In essence, saying, not only do we need these for our security, but we will continue to need them, but you yourselves should not have them. And at the Carnegie Endowment, we've been trying to formulate some ideas. We've put out a public report people can get from our website, where we say the only standards that will work are the ones that are universally enforced. It's not arguing that we should unilaterally disarm, but that we need to get serious about applying standards that apply to everyone. If we want Iran to give up the ability to produce materials that can be used in nuclear weapons, we shouldn't use them ourselves, and we should work with our allies to give that up too. Otherwise, we're condemned to play whack-a-mole for the indefinite future.
Mike Schuster, NPR's diplomatic correspondent, is also joining with us this afternoon from Los Angeles. Mike, I want to ask you, the question of Israel always comes up in the discussion of nuclear proliferation and its alleged nuclear program, which I guess is it's something I'd like you to address. What is Israel's nuclear status?
Well, Israel has never admitted publicly that it has nuclear weapons. It is essentially accepted around the world that Israel has gained a nuclear weapons potential. It may have a couple of hundred nuclear weapons. The United States has never pressed for nuclear disarmament as far as Israel is concerned, because Israel has stated that ambiguously that if it does have a nuclear weapons potential, it's an existential deterrent. It would only be used should Israel be attacked and the possibility that Israel as a state would be destroyed. Nevertheless, within the context of the Middle East, and now this brings in Iran as well as the Arab states, the Arabs and the Iranians have always argued that they will not be content to accept the Middle East as a nuclear weapons-free zone if Israel doesn't get involved in that discussion. Israel is outside the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It has never signed that treaty. And it is essentially in a kind of nuclear limbo with the backing of the United States. I should add that there have been recent statements from Israeli officials, high Israeli officials, expressing great uneasiness about the potential for Iran to gain nuclear weapons, and expressing the implicit threat that Israel might have to mount some kind of military strike, as it did against Iraq in 1981, if the problem is not solved diplomatically. So Israel is a great complicating issue when we talk about nuclear weapons, and especially nuclear weapons in the Middle East and Iran.
Let's take a call now. Vahid is on the line with us from San Francisco. Forgive me if I didn't get your name right.
No, that you got it quite right. Thanks very much. I am an Iranian living in the United States, and I wanted to give something more of an Iranian's perspective on this issue. In much of the discussion about nuclear technology in Third World, and specifically in Iran, very much like the discussion that we are having right now, and your experts are talking about that, nuclear technology is immediately interpreted as nuclear weapons. There is never an acknowledgement that there is a need for peaceful production of energy by nuclear technology in Iran. Even though Iran is a very oil-rich country, oil is a finite quantity resource. We already have seen many of our oil wells go dry. The origination of the nuclear technology in Iran was during Shah's time, with full approval of the United States. The power plant at Bushehr was specifically located at the Persian Gulf in order to generate energy to run the desalination plants. The mistake that is being committed is by not acknowledging the right of Iran for peaceful production of energy, suddenly this whole issue has become nationalistic, and there is no means of preventing the spread of nuclear weapon. Even let's assume that some elements in Iranian government have another motive in nuclear technology, and they want to develop weapons. They always can hide themselves under this disguise of peaceful technology. So what I'm saying, and excuse me if I cannot articulate it properly, if the world community acknowledges Iran's right for peaceful production of nuclear technology, then they will strengthen their hand and they will create new means to monitor as closely as is needed the process and prevent conversion of this nuclear technology to weapons grade.
Okay. Vahid, that's a very good point, and I want to throw that at our guests here. But first, I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Jack Pritchard, I want to toss that your way because North Korea has had much of the same, made much of the same arguments that its nuclear program is designed to provide power for its citizenry.
Yeah. Well, in the case of North Korea, it's I think it's probably worlds apart from that of Iran. But let me tackle the North Korean issue. North Korea's indigenous nuclear program is a 5-megawatt power plant. It has very little potential other than a little bit of steam that's bled off to the local community. It is certainly not a power-producing facility. It is a plutonium-making facility. In the case of North Korea, as part of the 1994 agreement to get North Korea out of the nuclear weapons building program, the United States and others pledged to build 2 light water reactors at a place called Kumho. What's happening now is, with the revelation in 2002 that North Korea may be embarked on a secret highly enriched uranium, a separate program, there is a distinct feeling, particularly within the United States, that North Korea cannot be trusted with a nuclear program, that their intentions all along have been to create or to use under the guise of a peaceful energy program this nuclear program for weapons making. Now, specifically to go back to answer one of the questions perhaps that Vahid is asking and another listener had asked. In the case of North Korea, this can be addressed in 2 ways. First of all, you address the question of the North Koreans' desire for security through a diplomatic solution in terms of all the 6 parties agreeing to North Korea's security, and that takes away their stated requirement for a need for a nuclear deterrence. And then you find a cheaper, more efficient alternative energy sources that will provide cleaner, faster, and more abundant energy sources for North Korea rather than continuing on the LWR projects that would take several more years if the United States Congress would even allow the technology to be transferred to North Korea.
Jack, we're going to have to end it there. Thanks very much for joining us today. Jack Pritchard was Special Envoy for Negotiations with North Korea for President Bush. He's now a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution here in Washington. John Wolfstahl is Deputy Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was here in Studio 3A. Thank you, John. And Mike Schuster, NPR's diplomatic correspondent in Los Angeles. Thank you, Mike. When we come back from a short break, groundbreaking campaign finance laws thrown into uncertainty just 6 weeks before Election Day. I'm Brian Naylor. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.